Hello and welcome to Ditching Hourly. I'm Jonathan Stark. On today's show, I am joined by guest Jimmy Rose, founder of Content Snare. Jimmy, welcome to the show.
Jonathan, really, really good to be here.
So Jimmy and I met when I came on his podcast, Agency Highway, and that was a fun talk. And then after we finished that, we sort of got to chatting about Jimmy coming on to Ditching Hourly to talk about how he validated the idea for his product. I have a lot of conversations with students who are thinking about building a SaaS, you know, because I have tons of software development people because my background's in software development. And a lot of times when they're thinking about, oh, I got to get away from this client rat race and this hourly billing is driving me crazy, one of the ideas that they often have, it's like, oh, I'll build a tool, I'll scratch my own itch, I will build it and they will come. And that makes me pretty nervous in most cases, unless there's like some kind of obvious market opening or they've got some kind of unfair advantage in this space. It makes me nervous. But still, sometimes people really want to do it. Sometimes I agree that it's not insanely risky. But one of the things I recommend they do first is make sure that they can reach the audience. How do you validate the idea of the product before putting 6 months of your life into it? So that's the theme for today. So if you're interested in maybe starting a SaaS product, then stay tuned. Let's start here. Jimmy, can you tell us first what Content Snare is?
Yeah, so it's generally aimed at marketing agencies and web designers, and it helps them get content from clients. So in agency land, it's a massive problem that holds up loads of projects when you sign a client up, they pay the deposit, they've agreed to sign up, build a website, whatever, could be a marketing campaign, and then you hit them with this request for information that they need to provide you so that you can actually do the job that they're paying you to do. And often the projects stall out there, sometimes weeks, sometimes months. And we actually used to run an agency as well. And, like you were kind of mentioning there in the intro, that SaaS is often a good way to get away from the hourly billing. And that's definitely what was going on in my mind. But yeah, so that was one of the big frustrations in our agency. And it turns out it was for other people as well. And that's what we help them with.
Cool. So I've got a bunch of questions already. So first, how is it different than, Dropbox or Basecamp or what are the differences there?
Yeah, cool. So there's two different things there. So Basecamp and project management systems. I'll tackle that one first. So that one, the biggest competitors I say we have are project management systems for one. And then number two is like Google Drive and email or Dropbox and email. So project management systems, generally the big thing that people struggle with there is clients don't want to use them. So if you invite your client into a system that they haven't used before. And obviously this applies to Content Snare as well, but I'll get to that. But like if they have to remember a password, like even that, you'd be surprised how much of a barrier that is for clients who are non-technical, right? Mm-hmm. Like it's something we run into all the time. Like people are like, I can't get them to use such and such. Yeah. And it's just the way it is, right? Like asking clients to learn another system, they're just going to throw their hands in the air and say no.
Yeah, can't I just email you?
Yeah, exactly right. Any system you use that there's any level of friction, they will default back to email. That's exactly what happens. Mm-hmm. And that's why Content Snare, like we spent so much time making the user interface dead simple. So we get feedback now, like just for reference there, like we used to have a bit of problem with churn where I guess if people aren't familiar with that term, just the people that are leaving our service each month. Mm-hmm. And the common feedback was couldn't get my clients to use it. And we did like this 12-month development, just making the client user interface. It's like we spent 4 hours looking at the text that was on two buttons just to go like, can it be misconstrued what these buttons do? Mm-hmm. And so we just went through so many different bits of text and whatever. So like just so that it's so easy that they can't screw it up basically for this reason, because they have to click a link in an email to submit their content and they have to know exactly what to do every step of the way. And since we put that new user interface in, the churn has dropped to almost nothing and we get like constant good feedback. So that's when we really realized we were onto something. Mm-hmm. But just to quickly touch on the other thing there, like Google Drive, Dropbox, whatever, email. So if you're using Dropbox or Google Drive, there's going to be some other part of it. So, you know, obviously email, you have to follow them up if they haven't put the things in Dropbox. If they've put something in Dropbox and it's not the right thing, you have to email them and refer to which file is wrong and why. And then they have to go in there and pull that one out and, you know, and they'll probably delete the wrong thing. Mm-hmm. You know, so you end up with these massive email trails on the side of these other systems anyway.
Yep.
And like version control, I guess, of like which, you know, if they put three of the same thing in there, which one's the right one? Like it all ends up pretty much taking just as much time with these shared
blue chair online. Final dot triple final. No, seriously, this is the last one dot PDF.
Classic. Yeah, right. And Google Docs is the same, right? If you give someone a document, there's just so much free range there that they start highlighting random bits and going, oh, like, please link this page to this text, this text to this page. And it just becomes a mess as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that sounds like you found a sort of some white space in between, I guess I would call them the obvious choices. But you know, it's not an ad for content scenario. What we really want to find out is, how did you validate the idea in the first place? So did you do any testing, or was it just like, we have this problem, therefore other people must have this problem? Or did you, like, what did you do?
Yeah, so we validated the hell out of it. And actually, when you were introing me before and talking about people in your audience that want to go and build something, and just because it's like a scratch your own itch thing, I get really nervous around that kind of thing as well. And this is not my first software product. So I've been through the process and probably validated things even heavier each time we've done it. So I guess that's come with experience, but there was no way I was going to build anything without first proving that people wanted it, just because it's so much investment to build a software product. And I see so many people that go through the motion, like you said, you know, go and build the thing and then build it and they will come, and then they don't come for whatever reason.
Oh, I've done it half a dozen times myself.
Oh, just
like back in the day. Yeah. It's like, oh, software is all powerful. And, you know, I the same thing. It's like, oh, this is, and here's the thing. Like, maybe other people had the same itch as me, but for whatever reason, it in my messaging or the connection, you know, they didn't connect, like, and I never, ever once with any of them had any kind of marketing plan, for crying out loud. It was always just like, I'll just make the website kind of cool and I'll tweet about it and it'll just, and hands will wave, magic will happen, and I won't have to be billed by the hour or whatever.
Never worked. Well, and sometimes it's just the fact that they don't want to pay for it, right? So it might not be a big enough problem. They might complain about it, but it might not be big enough that they're actually willing to fork out cash for it. And then how much of cash they're going to be willing to part with. And that's part of the validation process, right? So so the first thing this time for me was literally threw up a landing page. And I think it was in about a day, like I bought the domain and I bought the landing page and I said what it was going to do. We had planned out a bit of an idea of what we thought the software was going to do, just so we could, you know, highlight the problem, dig into the problem a bit on the landing page and then have a sign up, right? So it was like, when we launch this, you'll get notified kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And in the early days, it was just a matter of, sorry, I really need to back up here. Before I even did that, I interviewed people. And I think this was the best part of the whole thing, because I interviewed maybe 15 web designers, 20 web designers locally and through like online forums. Like I'm in some paid communities and I just did a shout out and said, hey, I've got this cool idea. Well, I've got this idea for web designers to save a bunch of time. And I'm just interested to speak to a few people and see if it's actually a problem for you.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, surprisingly, people took me up on that.
Yep.
You know, I always thought that people would be a bit, you know, wouldn't want to talk to me or whatever, but they did. And those conversations were amazing because the big thing that I learned from, I guess, other sources of information. Like, I didn't come up with this. This strategy is when you talk to people and find out about their problems, don't like seed your idea into their mind. Mm-hmm. Actually, just say, like, what are the biggest problems? And I was getting them to step through their business, right? And go, yeah. You know, from the client onboarding all the way through to offloading a project and sending them on their way or whatever it is. And, you know, almost all of them at some point spoke about content, collecting content being a really big pain. So that was the start, right? Even without me seeding the idea, they would talk about it. And once they had, and once I'd got an idea of what all their pains were, then I circled back and we dug into content specifically, because obviously that's what I was trying to talk about. You know, actually in the first few interviews, I didn't actually have an idea for content collection at all. I wanted to build a tool for briefing to improve the briefing process at the beginning of a project. And it just got turned on its head pretty quickly after like four people spoke about content. And I was like, yeah, actually that's a big problem.
Oh, I like the story even better now. So like, yeah. So like just to underscore that, you had an idea, you knew the target market, you interviewed them and they were like, no, we need this.
Well, so yeah, they didn't even really say no because I hadn't actually told them my idea yet, you know, and I didn't need to because they all spoke about content. So it flipped on its head like really quickly. I guess it's still part of that client onboarding phase. So it wasn't hugely different, but yeah, it very quickly, they just, I saw that content was a bigger problem than what I was trying to solve before.
That's awesome. Okay, yeah, so, and then from those interviews, how much of that, you know, made it into your marketing or made it into the product?
Yeah, and that is exactly why that part was so awesome, is the words that those people used was essentially what I wrote on the landing page.
Yeah, exactly.
Because the landing page was so easy to write when you've got the actual pain and frustrations in their exact words from your exact audience. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that's how much it, like the whole landing page at first was basically their language, as well as any emails that I wrote, you know. So obviously you have to take a, you know, pretty serious amount of notes, record those calls if you can, mm-hmm. especially if you're doing them on Zoom or whatever. Like back then I actually did a lot of them in person. So it wasn't, you know, I feel like Zoom, you probably got a benefit there because you can record them and get them transcribed.
Yes. Yeah, it's important to use the exact language. If you try to abstract it into a general category of problem, it loses all of its punch. There's something you can, when you read, I do website sales page teardowns all the time, and I can tell when I'm reading real pains and when mm-hmm. I'm reading made up pains. There's just something about it that you're like, oh, that it's almost like, they're almost like a joke. Like they surprise you in a way. You're like, oh, I wouldn't have even thought to put it like that. Or I wouldn't have even thought of that particular problem or that particular expression of the underlying issue. Sort of like a symptom of disorganization. It's like, you know, it's just wild. It's like, I find software developers, I don't know if it's common to the category, but certainly it was when I was doing software development all the time, full time, it was like my natural reaction to encountering any kind of business object, like in my work, to try and abstract it because it gives you more flexibility. But mm-hmm. if you do that in your marketing, it's a disaster because no one can connect the dots between, like they just don't feel the connection between the underlying problem you're talking about and the symptom that they are experiencing, the thing that's keeping them up nights. Like they're not going to connect the dots. They're like, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, how much messaging and marketing is a person exposed to in a given day? You know, something needs to jump out and grab them by the shirt and say, hey, you've got this pain, don't you? And using their exact words is the way to do it.
Yeah. And it makes it so much easier for someone like me, who's not really, you know, I've learned marketing over the years, but I feel like I'm coming from engineering, right? That's my background. And I feel like it took me about 7 or 8 years to unlearn feature-based selling, which is what I wanted as an engineer, mm-hmm. And to learn, you know, copywriting as it is now, as we do now, which is definitely not perfect. But when you're reflecting people's language, it's so much easier because you're just using what they said and then here's how we fix it, you know?
Right. And here's how to know. Oh, go ahead.
No, go for it.
Yeah. So just to the listener, if you're sitting there and you want to make a landing page and you're like, what should I write? No matter how hard you think about it, you're not going to come up with the answer. The answer is to go ask someone what you should write. But, you know, not in so many words, but like do these interviews, find out what the real pains are, and then just put what they said on the page, and it's going to be way more effective than anything you dream up in your head.
Yeah, and this is a process that's still going on with us. You know, I have whether it's testimonial sort of case study interviews, or you know, I try to speak with clients all the time for general whatever reason I can manage, basically to see if they're liking the software. If someone gives us a bad NPS rating, then which is just like a 0 to 10 score, how likely they would be to refer it to someone else. If they give us, you know, like a 5 or less, I'm probably going to try and jump on a call with them, find out what's going on. And all of the language that people use in these conversations is what gets reflected back into everything. And, you know, we engaged a copywriter to redo our homepage, which isn't live yet, but the first thing she asked for was customer interviews. So I had to do like 5 or 6 more, you know, jumping on Zoom and got them transcribed for her. And then she turned it into this awesome homepage. So even, you know, that's what professional copywriters are doing as well.
Okay, so let's get back to the timeline. So you did all the interviews, you stood up a sort of pre-sale, keep me posted page. What happened next?
Yeah, so it became a kind of standard audience building thing. And I guess that standard, we can dig into this a lot. But the reason I wanted to build some kind of email list is I'd been in business for quite a while at this point and seen the power of having an audience before a product. So I know a couple of people locally here that for years just had a social following. They just shared things that and built this audience in like the health space, I guess. And they didn't have a business for a long time. They were trying all these different things and it wasn't working until one day they basically just asked the audience what they wanted, built it, and then now they have like a really kick-ass business.
It's not rocket science.
Yeah, right. And so the whole time we've always been doing this like product, you know, come up with a product idea and then try to sell it. But this time I was like, well, we've got the idea, but why don't we actually just build an audience right away, right? So it wasn't just a landing page. We had a blog as a part of it. And because I was in agency space myself, I was kind of just giving away things that I'd learned innate, you know, writing blog posts about, I don't know, whether it's project management was one, and like hiring a project manager or hiring virtual assistants, you know, just things that we struggled with through our agency journey that I thought were going to be helpful for other agencies. And we'll share that content, right? So at the time, it was pretty much sharing it in Facebook groups. Now I think it's a little bit harder to do that. Like you have to actually build relationships with people in groups. You can't just show up and throw in a blog post because you're going to get shunned pretty quickly now because a lot of people try to do that in Facebook groups. But that was actually part of it, was building relationships with people that ran these groups and you know, maybe going seeing if I could go on their podcasts, you know, and talking about my agency journey and what we were doing now. So yeah, it was really just a matter of trying to get people back to our site in one way or another through content, you know, and where audiences already were. So podcasts and Facebook groups and maybe other blogs, or, you know, doing guest blogs. The guest blogs weren't a very good source of actual traffic and signups, but just whatever we could to get people back. You know, so sometimes that means things like Product Hunt for some people. Like we didn't have a product to launch yet, so Product Hunt didn't do a lot. Beta list was okay, you know, so we were just going to places where people look for things and then trying to get them back to our site. And we didn't build up a huge email list. I think it was about 400 when we sent out our first pre-launch email, which was the next stage in this, is to, you know, I mentioned before that sometimes people just aren't willing to fork out cash for something. And I think that's the most critical step in all of this, because, you know, if you just ask people, oh, is this a good idea? Do you think this is a good idea? Would you pay for this? People don't want to hurt your feelings and they're just going to say yes.
Yes, most people are polite.
Yeah, right. And I see it so much. And it actually, you know, it's almost what you're talking about in the intro, where it just, you find it concerning, because it is people, it's concerning that people are going to waste all this time that on something that is never going to go anywhere because they haven't got the right feedback from people. It's so hard to get good, real feedback from anyone because they don't want to hurt your feelings and they'll just tell you it's nice, even though that's way more damaging in the long run.
Yeah, it's
So
almost like you're better off saying, "Hey, I saw this new," like not telling them you're part of it. "Hey, I saw this new thing. What do you think?" And they'd be like, why not just use
right, that's a
Dropbox?"
good idea. I like
Yeah.
that. I can't do that anymore because people know that it's our products, but I always try to ask people to be brutal. I explicitly say, you are not going to hurt my feelings. We need brutal feedback. Please do not hold back. You know, every single time I say the same thing, basically. But the biggest vote of all, or the biggest feedback, best feedback you can get is if someone will actually pay for it. So if you put up a pre-launch page, and this is what we did. We sent out an email. I think we had two design mock-ups at the time. It was like the dashboard page and what your clients would see, something like that. It was very basic. You know, it looked good, but it was basic and it didn't actually work. They were just pictures. So we sent those out in a blog post and said, this is what we're going to build. And I think it wasn't a huge cost to it. You know, it was going to be like $60 or something for 6 months or a year. In hindsight, I should have done a higher price point on it, I believe. Because in the end, it was a lot of smaller freelancers we had sign up when our, I guess we were sort of aiming for smaller agencies. But you know, you know, it's fine now. It's come around, but that price point was still people still had to get out their wallet and get out their credit card and pay for that on the internet to say that yes, this is a problem that I want a solution to. So yeah, we haven't validated the product itself yet, but at least we're validating the pain. And you know, I think I did 25 copies. I didn't want to go too many, and they sold out within like 2 hours or something. And then I had a few people email me to ask if they could get in. And so to sell 25, 30 copies off 400 people in an hour, I was like, oh, maybe we're onto something.
Yeah, that's very positive. So let's get a little bit. I'm curious how long from when you posted the initial page online and started blogging and all of that, how long do you think it was before you did this, where you posted the dashboard and the client view? Are we talking like
Yeah, I
6 months or 6 weeks?
not quite. It would have been, I think, 3 to 4 months. I need to go back and look at my timeline, but yeah, it wasn't that long. So the landing page went up in November 2016, you know, from an Airbnb in Denver. Like I knocked it up on a like a Genesis theme while I was hanging out with some of my entrepreneur friends right before Brian Clark's digital commerce event. where he got Cake to play for us, by the way. That
Oh,
was just
wow.
awesome. Yeah, I was like, there's like 100 of us in a room and Cake's playing for us. So
Dang,
cool.
that is cool.
Yeah, it was. And then yeah, so that's when I started blogging and doing all the things I spoke about before. I think the pre-launch went out in like February or March, and the product was ready for beta testers in like May. Late May. So the whole process was 6 to 7 months, but you know, pretty quickly, 3 to 4 months in, actually 3 months in, we'd actually started to get some real feedback from people and the actual monetary commitment, which is why we continued, right? So if that didn't work, if you got no buy-in, that's you can it at that point. Give everyone their money back if there's only like five signups or something. And just move on, and then you haven't wasted all that time. But yeah, that was kind of our go forward point from there.
Yeah, and you still got 400 or 500 people on a mailing list who are from agencies that care about something. They're going to care about
Yeah,
something.
that's it.
And so I'm curious how you started, just at what point you decided to start writing code. And did you write it, or I know you have a co-founder. Like, at what point did you decide to start going beyond pretty pictures and actually building it? And then, because here's what I'm imagining. I'm imagining with all of this backstory and all of this research that you did, that you could create a bunch of mock-ups relatively quickly with a high degree of confidence and not have to iterate too much and say, either you build it or Mark just like bang this out instead of like having these design meetings while you're building.
Yeah, so that's one thing even when we were building big projects for clients, we would always do the designs first, right? Because it's so easy to just give that to a developer and get it done right. I think it's really important to get that UX component sorted first, and we had a good UX designer that we'd worked with on client projects before, but Yeah, the whole, especially because we're targeting agencies and designers, you know, it actually needed to look good
true.
As well as be functional. Sometimes you can get away without that for sure. Like our last product looked like trash, but it did the job. But look, I'm going to be very honest here and say that we did start writing code before we should have. I think we were writing in. Yeah, you know, and we were a development agency, so we had that ability. I think it's kind of fun to start playing around with things anyway, even if it's not that serious yet. You know, it's not our full-time gig. We're just trying to piece things together and see how it's going to work and see how it's going to look. So yeah, we had started building a little bit early on, but we didn't really ramp up until those pre-orders came in, you know, but we had developers on our books already. I'm used to be a developer. My business partner, you know, is an amazing developer. So we had those resources there already. He wasn't working on it in the beginning because we still had client projects. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so we just got some of our developers to work on it part-time, really.
Cool. All right, great. So then at what point did you feel like you hit the next level?
Ooh, there's been maybe only recently, like, I guess when we first launched it, it was, we got that initial growth, right? And actually looked really good. I think a pretty good benchmark for SaaS is like 10% growth a month. We got this initial launch and obviously using scarcity always works. So if you have some cheap price, you maybe a 50% off, like, you know, really significant discount at the beginning, and this is only available for the first 2 weeks or something, and you send out a few emails in the lead up to that, to the deadline. Scarcity is by far the biggest seller that I've ever experienced. So I think the second biggest jump in signups we've had is when we increased our pricing, you know, after a couple of
when
years.
When you increased your pricing.
Well, yeah, because there was a deadline before we increased it and we said we'd grandfather.
Oh, okay. There you go. So that makes sense. So I guess a more specific question would be, at what point were you sure that this was a going concern?
As in the problem itself?
No, that you were like, oh, wow, this is going to work. Like, this is going to be worth sticking with. Was it after that first launch or was it still a little bit later?
Oh, no. I think that happened in... maybe now, like last month.
So a few years.
Yeah, definitely. So what happened is we got this initial growth spurt and we were doing fairly well for maybe a year or something. And then it kind of got really flat. Like we were talking like 2% growth a month, which is just not enough for a small, you know, business just starting out. And that sat like that for probably a year. Mm-hmm. And there's the event that I spoke about before when we drastically revamped the client interface. So those complaints from clients started going away and our customers then kept hanging around.
Yeah, churn went down. Yep.
Yeah, so you can look at the growth trajectory and there's a very marked, like a gradient change in the growth, our growth, right? When that happens. And that was in November last year. And then obviously COVID hit. So we had 3 months of flat and now that sort of, I guess everyone's over it. COVID's not done, but everyone's over it. And the growth is going back on that trajectory from last November. And so that was actually our goal. In about December, we said, if we can't show month-on-month growth of, you know, more than what we're seeing now, then we need to make a decision. Mm-hmm. And now the decision, like everything has changed in the last 6 months. So I think that's what I would say. It's been about 3 years. Before we got to that point.
Okay. So, and, you know, you're doing lots of other things at the same time, at least content marketing wise. So what is a typical day look like or a week maybe, and how much of it is devoted to content snare versus other things that are maybe not specifically for that?
So, like most entrepreneurs, I suffer from shiny object syndrome. And yeah, I'm definitely not unique there. I think it's pretty common. Most entrepreneurs and business owners always want to do 100 things. And I've been really bad at controlling that in the past. So I've kind of put my foot down and started stripping away other things as much as possible. So our client work now, we are not taking on other clients. Like we've just put, I think about a year ago, we stopped and we had two projects that were continuing and one of those is finished and one of those is just like a you know, monthly retainer kind of gig and it helps us fund Content Snare a bit.
Yep.
So we can hire more people, you know, past where Content Snare revenue is just to try and grow it faster.
Yep.
But yeah, so these days it's probably going to be around 80%. The other 20% goes into, I mean, it's hard to say because I create a lot of content around productivity and automation just because I want to build an audience. Like I was saying before, the importance of having an audience for whatever you want to do is important because you can right. create businesses off the back of that. You know, like one day maybe Content Snare will get sold. So having that, you know, we don't actually plan on that, but you know, maybe it will happen. And then if we sell the audience with it, then it's starting from scratch. But at least if right. I have an audience, so that's why there's 20% there. But at the same time, that audience, you know, if people are into productivity and automation and they run a service-based business, they're actually potential clients for Content Snare anyway. So it definitely feeds into it. So, you know, everything still kind of feeds into Content Snare. I have my podcast for digital agencies and web designers. You know, that's yep. not directly Content Snare, but there's a Content Snare ad in every single episode. So.
Right. Right. And it's the same audience. Yeah. I think I read right. recently that, you know, 37 Signals, when they were starting Basecamp, they were still doing client work until they were doing like $1 million a year or something. They hit seven figures or something with Basecamp before they stopped doing client work. It was something like that. It was like a much longer period of time than I expected. And mm-hmm. I think that's, you know, the story here, I think the takeaway here for the dear listener is, it's the odds of this happening overnight are just like comically low. Like it's just not even realistic. I mean, it just doesn't happen. Like people are just like swamped with lots of different things to decide between, you know, there's like lots of people trying to get wallet share and you really have to, even if your thing is or would deliver tons of value, they need to believe that before they're going to pull their wallet out. They need to hear about it from somebody else. It's much more, I guess what I'm trying to say is the marketing piece is probably more important than the software piece, which I know is going to make a bunch of people's heads explode listening to this, but a lot of people can do the development piece. A lot of people can build the product, but connecting with the audience, building the audience and connecting with them, connecting, creating the value proposition and building the trust, that's way harder. It's very hard. It takes a long time. People don't just, you know, you don't walk up to somebody and say, "Hey, nice to meet you. What should we name the kids?" Like it takes time. You have to like let it spin out over time, build up trust. And I mean, even I'm thinking of a recent, I interviewed Paul Jarvis, who nice. Recently, I guess it was not one that recent, but interviewed him about the same sort of conversation we're having, which is about how did he validate the idea for Fathom Analytics? And, you know, he just tweeted like, "Hey, what would you think about like a privacy oriented analytics platform?" And he got like 1,000 retweets or 1,000 likes or whatever. And he's like, "Oh, okay." And did exactly, you know, similar. I don't know if he did. I don't remember him saying he did interviews. I think he did interact with people on Twitter for a certain extent. But then he just mocked up the interface. He's like, this is what the homepage would look like. He just like ripped open Sketch, created some, you know, pretty pictures and same, you know, put up a pre-order page yeah. or a tell me when it's ready page. And he just did those. He basically did as little as possible at each stage to validate or to justify the next level of time investment that would be required to get it to the next level. So at every point, he made sure that he still had people that were interested. And also, to your point, he's got a huge mailing list. He's got a really big audience. And he basically reached out to him and said, "Hey, I feel like, you know, I have this." He was bummed that there was no privacy focused analytics platform, but he didn't just run and build it. And I mean, it's got to be 2 years by now. And I think, you know, he's feeling like it's pretty, you know, it's a real thing. It's like it takes up a large portion of his time now, you know, according to his email on Sunday. I'm on his mailing list. So
nice.
Yeah. So it's like, if you imagine, so to bring it all the way back to the beginning, if folks are thinking about like, oh, I'm sick of client work, I'm sick of billing by the hour, I'm going to build a SaaS. It's like, okay, well, maybe in 3 years you'll be replacing your client income from it. I mean, do you feel like that's, I don't have actually stats on it, but from talking to people, I mean, I know lots of people that have built it and no one came. I know lots of people who have built something and ended up in this horrible no man's land where they're making like $500 a month, where they've got like four customers or something. And then it's like, it's like partially validated maybe. And then people who it really turns into a real thing, they're like, to get it to that level, it's years. It's years. Like,
I mean, there's a 1,000 day principle. I can't remember who coined that, but it's basically that it takes 1,000 days to replace your full-time income when leaving, building a business from a full 1,000 days of full-time work to replace your full-time income, basically. And I think it kind of applies to building any new business, and absolutely included on this one. And like you kind of mentioned there that it about like marketing and how difficult it is, and like we've been in that position for a long time. Not, I wouldn't say, we've got like four customers and we need to make a decision, but we were looking at that growth and going, well, maybe even though we had this like crazy hype at the start, like everyone was like, oh my God, I can't wait for this product. And like, again, we just got so much feedback and we did all the right things. We had that initial, pre-launch where people actually paid for it. Maybe I didn't ask for enough money, but then, we thought we'd done all the right things and then growth was still so low. But it turns out in that case, it actually was a product problem.
Yeah, the churn.
So that it just turns into like, there's marketing as well, but it's just been this like constant dance of like working on the product and working on marketing and like slowly building it up. And now we can see new signups every day and very little churn. And it's like, oh yeah, now we're good. It's taken 3 years to get to that point, and I wouldn't say we've replaced all our client income, because we had some pretty serious clients towards the end. But where it is right now is very comfortable, and the trajectory is good. So yeah, it's taken 3 years.
Yeah, that's funny that I've never heard that 1,000 day thing before, but that is, I mean, just thinking back, like without looking at my calendar, I'd say that's pretty close to exactly right for any pivot I've done in the past, where it takes like if whenever I've done like a serious pivot, it's like it is about 1,000 days of like a lot of work. And then you're like, oh, now I'm like where I was, but now I'm doing a new thing. You know, like a, and hopefully, ideally, at least in my case, and I'm gonna guess with you too, it's a lifestyle change. You know, you're like, I don't like this lifestyle anymore. This client stuff, I just don't like it anymore. I want a different kind of lifestyle that's less, got a longer leash, let's say. You know, lots of little customers instead of three giant ones.
And it's easier then to have someone else like to outsource support, and have someone else handling all those clients. I guess that's what wore me down about client work is having to be so hands-on with clients. Whereas like the support, I am a big fan of holding on to support for as long as possible. It's one of those like controversial opinion type things, I guess, that I hold, because a lot of SaaS people say do support as long as possible, but the amount of, sorry, they say get rid of support as soon as you can. I'm the opposite. I say hold on to it because you get some of the best feedback and you've got your finger on the pulse when you handle support yourself. We only stopped doing support about 2 months ago.
Yeah, there's I agree with that.
Yeah, it's been one of the better decisions I've made. I think it's how we get the feedback and how we come up with the ideas to make the product better.
Yeah, and I guess that'd be a good place to kind of wrap up is how much of your future product roadmap, to the extent that there is one, does it come straight from what people say they want or what you think they should want?
There's definitely a middle ground. So we don't go and have like a feature voting system that a lot of products do. Like a lot of people think they need one. And I mean, through other people's advice, like Startups for the Rest of Us is a podcast I've listened to for a long time, and other startup podcasts. Generally, the advice I hear is like, don't allow people to type in exactly what feature they want and then vote on it, because sometimes people just vote for the wrong reasons. You know, so the only roadmap we build is from what people are trying to achieve on support. They write something in and they can't work something out. Something might be a little bit too difficult for them. And so we might come up with a feature to, and if we notice a lot of people are struggling with the same thing, then we'll come up with a feature to fix that. Sometimes it's a direct, you know, feature request, like, oh, I want conditional logic on, on our content forms, which, you know, that's fairly simple. Most, forms tools have that. So that makes sense. We know how to build that. But there's no formal system where people can go and vote, and that's intentional. We actually want to talk to people about each feature and get their, you know, what they're trying to achieve before we go and just design a feature because a bunch of people asked for it.
Right. Yeah. I like that. I like that middle ground. I mean, I know as a user of a couple of different SaaS, I'm thinking of Drip specifically because they're moving into a new space and I'm no longer like in their target market. So for them to listen to a thing I have to say, if I was requesting features, I'd be trying to pull the product in the wrong direction. And, you know, and they're slowly making changes that eventually people like me are going to leave and go somewhere else. And that's totally, it's clearly intentional. So I do like that. I do like that you've sort of got one foot on each side of the fence where, you know, people are, you know, you're like, yeah, I want to listen and I want to make people's lives easier. But at the same time, I'm not going to pull the product into like, I don't know, more of a project management thing or whatever, in a direction that you don't want to go.
Yeah. And you will get all kinds of features like that. People will request everything. Absolutely everything. Yeah. We've definitely been asked for project management style features, you know, and we don't want to be, you know, I'm not going to compete with ClickUp or Teamwork or something. Right.
Yeah.
So there's absolutely no way. And I'm a believer in, you know, master of what you do rather than jack of all trades. So, and I can see products that have that like public roadmap, public voting getting pulled in so many directions and it becomes just this mess so fast.
Yeah.
And I don't want to be that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I like the opinionated thing a little bit better.
Yeah.
But you can't shut them out completely. So, okay. So to wrap it all up, I think the biggest takeaway from this, other than, hey, if you want to start a SaaS, it's going to take a while. But the big takeaway is really about validating the idea first. And, you know, what you've laid out here, I think is exactly the way to do it. It's exactly the way to do it, in my opinion, where you're risking as little as possible, you know, whatever resource you have to spend, whether it's, a few bucks or a few hours, risk as little as possible, find the audience, talk to the audience, validate the idea through conversation, and then say, you know, I talked to 10, 15 people, I'm seeing some patterns here. And then sort of validate those patterns. Like now it's a hypothesis. Now I'm going to test the hypothesis with a bigger group of people. A lot of people are interested. They sign up and you just like, it's like, it's sort of like a spirals out from the middle. It feels like there's like this cycle and it just keeps getting bigger every time it goes around, instead of building like this giant product. And then my most hated phrase in all of software is then trying to find product market fit. Like what? Do that first. If you can't find somebody first that's interested in this idea, how are you going to find them after you spend 6 months developing it? And like, you can't skip that. You're going to have to do it at some point. Why not do it first instead of last?
Yeah. So I might be a little bit contrarian on that because I felt the same until that exact thing I was talking about before with the step change in the graph. I feel like that was product market fit for us. You know, we had a product and we had a market, but the market weren't getting the maximum amount of value from it until we found that the problem.
Okay. That's a nuance,
right? I feel like that to me, that's what product market fit is. It's like finding the exact product and the exact things that will actually gel with that market.
Okay, maybe I don't understand the phrase. To me, that sounds like you just improve the product. To me, product market fit was always about, and I could be wrong about this because I don't really read all that startup stuff. But to me, it always meant how to position your product so that people understood the value proposition.
Yeah, right. Well, yeah, if you look at it that way, then you definitely want to do that straight up.
Yeah, that is
Absolutely,
what you
yeah.
did, right? And so maybe I just have a right. Maybe I just have like a noob understanding of what the phrase means. But okay, cool. Well, I think this is going to be very helpful for people who've I know loads of software developers are listening. I know loads of them probably have an idea for a SaaS. So, you can just I fully agree with the process that Jimmy laid out about the very beginning of Content Snare. So give it a shot. I mean, I'm all for people building new cool stuff. I just can't stand the idea of that failure. It's just so demoralizing when you spend all that time, maybe even some money, and you create this thing and then just crickets. It's the worst feeling. So you don't want that feeling. So here's a plan to avoid that feeling. It's just follow these steps and figure out if anybody cares and then build it.
Yeah. And if you spend a lot of time in that first stage with the talking to people about their problems, at some point you're going to get a SaaS idea. Like that was always our plan for this one. There was 15, 20 interviews at the start there, but before that, I always talked to people about their problems. Like that's how we came up with our last software product as well. We saw what people were complaining about or like, so just talking to people, at some point you're going to notice patterns in the things they struggle with, especially if they're in the same industry. That's, I think, the biggest thing is just having your ear to the ground, trying to find a problem that someone would pay to solve.
Perfect. Yeah, that's a great place to leave it. I love that. All right, folks. So, Jimmy, where can people go to find out more about you online?
Sure. So contentsnare.com is the product if you want to check that out. And jimmyrose.me is my personal site where I blog about productivity and automation. And there's a YouTube channel there as well if you search for jimmyrose.me on YouTube. That's kind of where I'm releasing most of my content these days.
Great. All right. I hope people go check that out. I'll add links to the show notes. And that's it for this time. I'm Jonathan Stark, and I hope you join us again next time for Ditching Hourly. Bye. Hey, Jonathan again. Do you have questions about how to improve your business? Things like value pricing your work instead of billing for your time, or positioning yourself as the go-to person in your space, or maybe productizing your services so you never have to have another awkward sales call or spend hours writing another custom proposal? Book a one-on-one coaching call with me and get answers to these questions and others in the time it takes you to get ready for work in the morning. Best of all, you're covered by my 100% satisfaction guarantee. If at the end of the call you don't feel like it was worth it, just say the word and I'll refund your purchase in full. To book your one-on-one coaching call, go to jonathanstark.com/call, Call. That URL again is jonathanstark.com/call. Hope to see you there.